Thank you for joining us for this episode of Journey Now, produced by Journey Church in Brentwood, Tennessee. For more information on Journey Church and our gatherings, visit journeytn.com.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to this week's episode of the Journey Now podcast. We had recorded a complete and beautiful episode here live in studio that had all sorts of audio issues. And so we are now recording with three of us via Zoom. So certainly the audio will sound not as up to par as normal, but we figured there were still parts of the conversation we thought were definitely worth re-recording. And so here we are. I'm here with Susie Lind and Alyssa McNally, and we are delighted to have a place in your life and at your table as we talk about some stuff that's just going on and questions that we get. Today, we want to talk a little bit about some church stuff. We got a great question that came in to Susie, and Susie, why don't you cue it up for us?
Yeah, the question came after a couple weeks ago when we talked about a little bit about Hillsong, but mostly the conversation was around mega churches and the mega church mindset and how big is too big of a church and all that business. And so the question that came, which is a great question, was what do we do at Journey if something that we put out there content-wise, a podcast, a sermon, or music from one of our artists goes viral and tons of people flood the doors and start coming to Journey and we're busting at the seams and, you know, we, whatever we do about that and however big we get, like, what do we do if you can't help it when lots of people come, which by the way, we welcome visitors here at Journey Church. You're welcome to come and try us out.
Yes.
See how you like it. See how you fit and what you can participate in. But yeah, I mean, that's, you know, we've never been a church that's been focused on growth models, and we don't even count how many people are here on Sundays. This last Sunday, I thought to myself, I should probably count how many people are here. And then I'm like, it's really too much work.
The only counting I do is how many people stay awake. and that's usually fairly quickly and done on one hand. So that's no problem. I love the question because mega church, one of the things we want to suggest is that mega church isn't a size of church. It's an approach to church. Mm-hmm. That values mega things. You know, usually it's the ABCs, attendance, buildings, and cash. Those are all the big metrics. And it carries with it the assumption, and this is how it was always heard to me, healthy things grow. So if your church isn't growing, it's not healthy. And it also imports, if it's not careful, American ideals of largeness equals success, crowds always equal good, and influence is the goal of what church ministry should be like. And we would just simply, you know, start by questioning those assumptions as they're presented and discussed in the New Testament by Jesus and Paul in particular. So for us, mega church, you can be a small church and have a mega church mindset. You can be a large church. And remember the first church in Acts, I mean, 3,000 people came to faith the day Peter preached his first Pentecost sermon. And that wasn't necessarily a bad thing. In fact, Acts is continually pointing out that there are daily people kind of being brought into the church. You and I, Susie, have worked in large churches.
Alyssa, I have not worked in a mega church.
You've
large
not?
Large church, but not a mega
large
church.
Large church. Okay.
Right. What makes it a mega church?
Yeah.
Ooh, good question.
See, this is the question. Because, I mean, I remember my church that I worked in before this. It grew really fast in a short amount of time. But the most people we had, you know, in its heyday was like close to 2,000 people total. And
so
I remember
tiny.
People, but I remember people,
church,
well, I don't know, because I remember people saying like, are we going to become a mega church? Like that would be the worst thing that could possibly happen. You know,
I have,
what would you say, Alyssa? What's a mega church?
I've worked for churches with over 2,000 people in it before. So, I mean, I was the communications director, wasn't a pastor. But I would say that's a mega church. Once I walk in and I don't know your name, but you go there all the time, to me that becomes pretty mega.
So for you, mega church is a size. Like, you cannot do church once it hits a certain size.
Yes. Yeah.
But I don't know. I don't know everybody's name at Journey. And I'm one of the pastors here. And it's not certainly not a mega church. Is
that
it?
True? I mean, culturally, it's not considered a mega church. How many people, like, you don't count?
I don't count.
But do people's faces at least look familiar to you?
Yeah, there's a lot of people whose faces look familiar to me. And you're asking that at a very interesting time in our church. But like, yeah, there's a lot of people whose faces are very familiar to me, and a few of them whose faces are familiar to me. And I don't sadly know all their names. And there's, you know, we're in a time now we're not really post COVID, but at this point in the pandemic, you know, we're at a point where there's people are all over the place, renegotiating their relationship with the church. And so there's people coming and going, and it's very fluid right now. So I don't know.
And Alyssa, you echo something Eugene Peterson is quoted to have said, which is, you know, if you can't know everybody's name, you know, then the church has gotten too big. Because the churches as conceived in the New Testament are meeting in homes and living rooms, you know, 15 to 20 people tops, until the Acts thing exploded, but then they immediately filtered into homes. We do have some indication they met as a large group, or a larger group, but primarily it was all around tables and homes. And so, no, I think there's something to the size, that size does complicate the functions of the church. I think that's true.
I think there's also, like, I mean, there's so many different ways we could talk about it. We could talk about, you know, the purpose behind gathering, what happens when it gets bigger or gets smaller, like, what are the pros and cons of that? I mean, I do remember going to college and leaving the church that I grew up in and mourning the loss of that Sunday experience where I got to come in and I knew every single person. And there was something about, it wasn't just because I was a pastor's kid, like, everybody knew everybody. Like, my friends knew everybody too. It wasn't just like, because I was a pastor's kid, I knew who everybody was. Like, there was roughly, like, I think 200 people who went to our church, which isn't small. It's still a significant amount of people, but like, I knew them. They knew me. They knew what it looked like if I was having a good day or a bad day. Like, I was known. And there's a lot of growth that happens in safety, of being known. So to me, that was what church was. Until I went to college and I had to go to a different church because I moved out of state and started to experience church in a different way. Obviously, like, learning 200 people's names if you've only been there for a few months is a lot different than when you've been there from the beginning of the church. But mm-hmm. I just think that there is significant growth and discovery, I think, that can happen in the context of smaller communities. Now, a lot of times mega churches do have the smaller communities within their large communities. So my husband and I worked with Brentwood Baptist for a long time, and we went to one of their smaller communities within their large mega church community. So we had our own church within the larger church. I obviously, like, understand all these things. I guess the bigger question is, what is the Journey's purpose of that Sunday morning experience, and what's the point of the mega church experience, and like, what are the differences between the two?
Well, I think part of the issue is, in the conversation we're having now, we're reducing church to the Sunday morning gathering and counting the people there, and mm-hmm. that's what we're measuring. Yeah. And you know, that is an offense to the New Testament conception of what this is supposed to be. So we're already, if we've fallen into the trap of defining the church by its gathering, we've already lost. we've already been Americanized and consumerized.
Well, haven't we already lost by existing then? Because I mean, there's an element of like the fact that Journey and Church of the City and Brentwood Baptist all exist within a couple of miles of each other is a failure of the New Testament, right? Like, we're all supposed to be one.
No, not necessarily. There are cities that had multiple house churches that would be led by different people. So I don't know that that itself is a failure. I think the failure isn't that we shouldn't gather.
But then what? Sure. It's still gathering together, but we're a different entity. And not really coming together to, I mean, I'm just taking your point and making it, extrapolating it. It's a great word that I'm using perfectly, but I just think that let me make
the other point first, because I was heading a different direction, Alyssa McNally.
Okay, I'm here for it. Interrupt me. Okay.
And no, I was just going to say that embedded in Americanized Christianity is the equating of the gathering, the Sunday gathering, and whatever it is that service is with the church. And obviously the New Testament doesn't even start there. I mean, that is the most shallow definition of what a church could be. So if you were asking about, okay, so what's Journey's purpose in gathering, I want to ask the prior question of not just the gathering bit, but what's a church? What is a church? And then whether or not it gets, so for me, mega isn't necessarily a size, although you bring up great size points. I want to say mega is the Americanized capitalistic expression of church that is, I think that is very corrupted by the powers and principalities, and it needs to be rethought in 1,000 different ways. Now, if we want to go to, okay, maybe that's true, but then how come all of these churches exist next to each other? They don't partner. There's no unity. That for sure is a failure of the New Testament vision of church. No question. It does seem like there were rival house churches in a city, but Paul, you know, so clearly addresses how just what the lunacy that is. Mm-hmm. So yes, in some senses, because we're already embedded in thought forms and social orderings that are already corrupted, and we're trying to kind of fight our way out of those, we are starting from negative. We are starting from behind. And so to some people, let's just get together and meet in a small group. But you're still conceiving of church as a meeting. And that's the, you know, that's where we get off foot, regardless of how big the meeting turns out to be. Susie, what do you think?
So it's the approach to the church.
Well, I think that's one piece of it.
Yeah.
Well, I think there are very toxic ways of leading, approaching, and looking at the church. And I know, Susie, you've experienced, you know, some of these as well. What comes to mind when you hear this phrase mega church, or what is it that we would want to avoid if we were to grow?
I mean, when I think about a mega church, the first things that come to my mind are like large size, heavy programs, celebrity-ish pastor, everything really kind of buttoned up. And so I think it's really easy as an outsider to a community to make those assumptions. You know, but some of these places, you know, like there's a large church here in town that is, I mean, I think it would probably be considered a mega church because of its size, but they give a lot of money away and it's beautiful. I mean, they are truly working towards living into their name, Church of the City, by giving of themselves and their resources away to the city, which I think is a beautiful thing. And so, but I'm not a part of that community to know, you know, the ins and outs of how their culture works through the congregation. That interview that, or that podcast where we started talking about this was, you know, it was in response to Brian Houston's interview with Savannah Guthrie. And he said that a church can never grow too big. It just has to grow into its size. And that's where the challenge is, I think, because I mean, every church I've been a part of has, I happen to be drawn to churches that have severe growing pains. So, I mean, the ones that I've been a part of, it's, I've lived through lots of growing pains of, in terms of infrastructure and clarity of mission and staffing and things like that. And the ones that I've been a part of have also had a person who's been, you know, the founder or the head, that people are there for that person. And so, you know, if we're not, it's just a constant, like this is our work, is it's not a corporation or an organization. It is, but that's not the priority. The priority always has to be the people and our relationship with God and each other. And when we lose sight of that because of whatever capitalism or other ideals have, you know, infiltrated the way it's going, then that's when, I think that's when it gets dicey. But I'm a big, I have a high value for churches working together and being in unity with each other. That's really important to me. And I am always like praying for and looking for ways to make that happen. And mm-hmm. it's easier in some areas than it is others for some reason. But I think as you, when you said that, Alyssa, when you brought that up, that really pulled on my heartstrings, because I feel like, yeah, like that's a big deal, because we really are one body and we serve one king and one kingdom, and it doesn't always appear that way, I think. So
I just think it's interesting, because like in order to obviously have a mega church mindset, it's like you're saying, to be like, I belong to this group of people led by mm-hmm. this person, and it's very like, for lack of a better word, cult-like, because it's like, these are the people I'm going to rally with. And it's, to Mike's point, like, you're missing the point of what it means to be the church. I mean, to be the church is to love ourselves, to love God, and to love others. And so who, like, you gather, yes, with other believers as part of what it means to follow Jesus, mm-hmm. but it just starts to get a little unnecessary, right? Like, it just feels a little unnecessary mm-hmm. to have a mm-hmm. have this like experience where it seems like you're almost worshiping a gathering or a person, you know, rather than Jesus. So yeah, I think there's so many different factors, like the many different gatherings, the many different churches is a beautiful thing, but when it starts to become more about which club you're in, I think that starts to become some dangerous territory where we grossly misrepresent what it means to be yeah. the church, and letting things like how much money or how much fame or how good the speaking is or how good the music is be our main drivers for gathering also becomes like just a sad misrepresentation of what Jesus wanted it to be.
Yeah, no, for sure. And that's, so let me ask this, let me pivot to this. What, so size, so I guess we could say something like, just because it's large doesn't mean it's bad. And just because it's small doesn't mean it's good. But more numbers can introduce difficulty in the same way that wealth introduces difficulty. It's not impossible to be wealthy and follow Jesus. Jesus says it's harder. So what are things that we look for? What are things that you guys look for in terms of health? If mega church could be construed as an approach, what are the opposite things that you're interested in seeing in a community to determine whether or not it's healthy?
Go ahead, Alyssa.
Wow. I mean, she just bounced that basketball into my court.
Yeah.
What does it look like for it to be healthy? I think it's a great question. I think it's very arbitrary. I also think it has more to do with the individual and the types of individuals that you have in your space. I would say that the more diversity you have, the more healthy it is. So I think if you're gathering with other people who think like you do, or in the exact same stages you do, who, you know, do the exact same things that you do, and you're just gathering with the echo chamber of, you know, just the same thought as you, then it's probably not super healthy. I think being with people
if you're never challenged,
than you, yeah, people yeah. that are like, you know, thinking outside of the box, they're in different seasons of life. You're, you know, there's people that, you know, that have a different lifestyle than you, but they're still gathering with you. They're still loved by you. They're still teaching you things, and vice versa. I think to me, that's the healthiest version of the church. It goes, you know, from socioeconomics to race to lifestyle, gender, et cetera. I think all of those things have to coexist for something to be, for a group of people learning and living together. I think that's what I would define as healthy.
Good. So diversity.
If you made me write that down, that's probably what I'd say.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. And it's consistent with things you've said lots of other places. Mm-hmm. The diversity of viewpoint, diversity of person, that if it's just one type, if you could literally stereotype the church, then it's not the new humanity Jesus died to create. What would you say, Susie?
Well, I think my answers would come from my bent of being a formation pastor. I'll just acknowledge that from the get-go. I think, you know, I like to listen to what people say about their church and about our church, and I pick up on things. And so one thing I pick up on, like, is if somebody, whether it's here or another church, if somebody is talking about how much they love their church because they love the message and the pastor and what he or she is saying, and it's the reason why is because it's so good, but it's everything that they already know and believe, I kind of question that. Because, and I used to be, this is coming from someone who used to be afraid of hearing things that I wasn't familiar with, that I've never heard before, that, you know, but I think if you are in a place where you're being challenged or provoked to think differently about God and Jesus and the Spirit and the new humanity and the kingdom, and it provokes you to further become curious about those things in a way that, you know, is healthy, then I think that's really good. You know, just going somewhere that just affirms what you already know and believe, I think isn't super helpful anymore. I also like think, you know, like if it's a place that seems to, this is going to sound really cliche, but if it stirs your affection for Jesus, and it stirs you up to love others more intentionally, well, better, whatever word you want to use there, I think that's healthy as well. Because we're certainly, like, you know, our theology is that we're saved by faith and not by works, but your works are a response to what you believe and what you think theologically. And so what you do with what you believe is how your faith moves in and through you in the world. And so if you're not experiencing that as a result of the community that you're a part of, as it draws you into your relationship with God, then I would, you know, I would ask some questions. I spent some time on the phone with a friend today that doesn't even live in our area and is really struggling with their church. And I just kind of listened and asked some questions. And I think a big part of it is, are you able to show up? Are you able to show up as who you are with your gifts and what you can bring to the table? Because I think often we go to a church to see what it can do for us and what it can provide for us and how we're fed and if we like X, Y, and Z. But we rarely walk into a church and think, okay, what can I offer here? What can I be a part of? How can I show up, because that is what church is. It's people coming, it's God's people coming together to worship, adore, and serve him and love him and others. And so if we lose sight of that, then you can have five people and be a mega church, I guess.
Right. No, for sure. And it's super subtle, right? Because mm-hmm. when you get money involved, the people up front have a financial mm-hmm. incentive to appear more Jesus-y, more holy than they actually are. And so it's man, there's some tough lines. Mm-hmm. For me, it's all about how leadership operates. How does conflict happen? How are people treated who disagree? Who is there real accountability for the whoever the head entity person is? Is there real accountability? I've just seen so many churches, you know, that are full of people that are just there to say yes and to rubber stamp things, and they're not. I mean, we just see so much abuse and money, sex, and power mm-hmm. about that. And so, is power distributed? Is money transparent? The leadership humble? Are they competitive against other communities? Is their work a zero sum game? If a church wins, we lose, as opposed to no, it's a kingdom, man. We're actually and are they motivated primarily from a concern of self-preservation? Right, that's where churches go to die. Is when all of a sudden, you know, keeping the brand alive becomes more important than anything else. And so for me, that's all the stuff I'm attentive to, on top of what you both have said. I mean, what you both said is absolutely, absolutely right. For me, I've just seen so much abuse at the top of the thing mm-hmm. that that's where my focus is naturally going to go, you know, and we're just seeing the fruit, the rotten fruit of having unhealthy systems and structures in place. And there are so many of us who've been hurt by those things.
So Mike, how does it feel for you having been a lead pastor, a teaching pastor, having been at the top of some of these things before, and then stepping away for a few years, and then now you're stepping into, you know, a role where you're in front of people almost, you know, every week, and you're part of a community in a different way again than you have been in a long time. Like how does it feel for you as you've grown? And I mean, some of these ways of the way you think has, I'm guessing, changed quite a bit over the last 10 years, right?
Sure. Yeah.
So how does it feel for you now today?
Well, and I know you didn't mean this, but any use of the word top is, you know,
did I say that?
Yeah, the top of the organization. Sorry. No. I'm making a point that is so easily dismissed in our language, right? Our language mm-hmm. says, "Oh yeah, mm-hmm. of course, if you're going to be the greatest, you must be servant of all." But you know, I had my own parking space. I had a shower. I had a shower in my office. Or attached to my office, I should be clear. Well, it was the other guy. I didn't build it. I'm just saying, but I picked the one with the shower in it, doggone it. It is much harder in those locations to embody the reality that Jesus did, which was to take his rights and privileges and to not claim them, but rather to expend himself for the sake of other people. And so for me, it used to be important to be a leader of a church, and I would still say I am, but it is much less important to do that than it is to be a part of a healthy community and a healthy team culture. And I used to vastly overestimate my organizational leadership giftings, when what I have is motivational leadership and catalytic leadership. I do not have the Kevin, Susie, Alyssa gift mix of just rad detail and organization, listening and loving. I'm like, if you need to stir up, you know, a bunch of people to go do something, okay, I can help. To really lead a church as a family and an organization, it's not my gift. And it hurts the church if I'm robbing somebody who's much more gifted to hold that role. So for me, it's actually great because I am passionate about teaching. I have opinions on everything, but I don't have to sit through a lot of meetings, and hallelujah for all of that. So, and I just recognize how extraordinarily gifted our team is. And so, you know, Kevin, we can talk about him because he's not here, does he get credit for being Alyssa's father, which, you know, how he made it. We're still praying for him.
He would say that's his greatest accomplishment, I'm sure.
I absolutely would. The kind of humility needed to surround yourself with hugely strong, gifted other people is very uncommon in my experience in churches. Usually church leaders are insecure and threatened and lead out of fear and not faith. And I speak from, you know, personal experience. Kevin is the kind of person, and I don't mean to switch this into a, hey, aren't we great thing, because that's not what I mean at all. But since you asked, the culture here to me is not a top-down culture. And that is what's so attractive to it. You know, it's like, no, there's some really gifted people who know where their gifts are and who contribute in other places, but we have, you know, pretty secure sense of where we belong. And I think that's a beautiful thing. So for me, it's great.
That's awesome.
You're awesome. Okay. Well, I tell you what, let's just agree that the interview we had with Timmons that, you know, got wrecked was way worse than this one. And so I think
we fought more in the first one. So this one was less dramatic.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's a good ratio of roses and thorns. All right. So let's just consider that for a second. I want to thank, as always, our friend Randy, who does all the work, and our friend Grant, to put these things out. And we're grateful for you. Thank you for the questions. I get the most out of this because these are such good and stimulating questions, and to have such phenomenal conversation partners is really a joy. So we hope you enjoy this. We're going to turn it over to Susie for an interview. As always, please like, rate, and subscribe. That helps the Amazonian overlords and the Apple overlords and the Google overlords know we exist and we're nice people. Until then, friends, we'll see you next time.
Thanks, everyone, for tuning into the Journey Now podcast. We're changing gears a bit as we step into this conversation I recently had with Sam Barnhart, who is our care pastor here at Journey. You may or may not know that Sam was part of a band called Bleach, and his journey from being a musician to becoming a pastor is quite an interesting one. I hope you'll enjoy my conversation with Sam, and if you want to connect with him after this, you can reach him at sam@journeytn.com. Ladies and gentlemen, I am here with my very good friend and cohort.
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 I like that.
We're a cohort.
Cohorts.
You're not a cohort. We are a cohort.
Together.
Together. Yes. Mr. Sam Barnhart.
Yes. Hello, everyone.
For those of you that do not know, Sam is our care pastor here at Journey, and he does a really good job at what he does. He's awesome.
Thank you, Susie.
But we're here to talk about a whole different thing before that.
Yes.
So one of the fun things that we're doing this summer at Journey, as we are re-engaging in life together, is we're putting on a super fun music festival for the whole family, the whole community on July 17th. It's called Journey Fest.
Yep.
So tell us about that.
So, July 17th, you know, like we all know, the last year and a half has been hard to engage community in any kind of what we've always experienced as normal. And so, yeah, we decided that this would be a great opportunity this summer to do something that our hope is that most people feel comfortable being at. It's outside. It's something for the whole family. We've got everything from, you know, a bunch of fun inflatables for the kids and families, food trucks, and then a bunch of cool artists that are going to play. So, and it's from 4 to 8 p.m. on July 17th. So mark your calendars.
That's awesome. And we have a great lineup
Yes.
of local artists.
Yep. Actually, the thing that I'm really excited about is they're all part of our community.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and we've never been a church that, like, hey, let's highlight all the cool artists we have at church.
Mm-hmm.
But I also think there's something to knowing, like, what do you do? Like, what do you do for your, you know, as a living? What do you do for, and so, yeah, so we've got a bunch of cool artists I'm excited about. And it's a pretty diverse lineup, which I think there's going to be something for everybody with it. You want me to share?
Yeah,
here?
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Share the
So we have Aaron Bucks. Mm-hmm. So if you're familiar, if you come to Journey or you're familiar with Journey, so Lindsay Buckles is our children's pastor and her husband, Aaron. Is going to be playing that day. He's great. It's great. It's just kind of a poppy, fun, pretty chill, sit on the beach and drink your margarita kind of music. A gal named Betsy Lane, who is a singer-songwriter.
Mm-hmm.
She's incredible, amazing voice and just amazing talent.
Mm-hmm.
Him and Her Worship, who are actually pretty new to the Journey community in the last few months,
but really lovely people.
Yeah, incredible. Seth and Jenna, love them, and just have loved getting to know them and their heart. And so, really excited to kind of highlight what they do. And then Copper Lily, who is Tim and Stephanie Skipper, who are, you know, Tim's one of our elders. They've been a part of Journey for a lot of years, and just have really, really helped kind of shape and mold who we are as a community as well.
For sure.
And then, I don't know, some of you may or may not know that that was part of my story. It's what brought me to Nashville was music. And so I was in a band called Bleach, and we're going to play that night as well. So, yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah. So.
And, like, I want to get to the Bleach story.
Okay. All right.
But I think it's really important also to note that we had, like, a long list of really great people to choose from. And we're hoping that this is the first of many.
Yes. It's not a one and done.
No.
This was just kind of the, like, let's try this.
Yeah.
Let's, you know, because the reality of it is we're in Nashville, and there's a lot of places to go for music, but Brentwood doesn't necessarily have very many. And so I'm excited to, you know, a part of our vision for Journey and this building and everything has been, like, we want the community to use it. We want it to be something that is not just a Sunday morning. It's like, that's pointless.
Yeah.
And so I'm excited to, we have a great venue here, and I'm excited to be able to utilize that to help and encourage, and also just to highlight, like, hey, we have this amazing talent that's here at Journey.
Yeah.
So
that's cool.
So there's a ton more that we just, you know, for this particular event, that we weren't able to kind of utilize everybody, but the goal is, hey, yeah, let's just continue to do it if this works and it makes sense. So,
for sure.
Yeah.
That's great. Okay, so the band Bleach.
Okay, here
so
we
you,
go.
You came to Nashville for music.
That's right.
You started this band with your friends.
Okay, this is
I'm going to just tell you what I know.
Okay, tell me what you know, and then I'll tell you what's right and what are rumors.
So you started this band with a group of friends when you were a wee lad.
I was about 19 years old. Yeah.
And you guys, you know, you did pretty well. You went on the road, you toured with some amazing people.
Yeah.
And that band has been your, like, consistent community for probably the past 20 years.
They're my best
friends. They're your best
friends
still, which, you know, I hear people in bands, that's not always the case.
That's true.
So
actually, it's about 30 years now, which is crazy.
That is crazy.
So, I can back up and give you just, I'll give a little.
Well, here's what I want to know.
Okay.
And here's what I want to know. And I think maybe what other people want to know is, like, what was that like, and how has that shaped you into who you are? And how did you get from that to becoming a care pastor of a little church in Brentwood?
Kind of random, huh? Yeah, I know. So I grew up in a little town called Fortville, Indiana. Mm-hmm. Like, it's literally one of those towns. We have one stoplight, a liquor store, and a Dollar General, mm-hmm. And a Dairy Queen, which is in every little town, right? So it was a town of about 1,500 people when I was growing up. Mm-hmm. And for me, music has always been a part of our family. It's my grandma and grandpa. My grandpa was a stand-up comedian, and he was in a gospel quartet. And my grandma, she's 90-some years old, and she still teaches 40 students a week piano, lives by, I mean, like, so, like, it's just been a passion of our family forever. And when I was about 11 years old, my mom and dad bought me my first Christian rock and roll, quote unquote, CD. And it was a band called DeGarmo and Key.
Okay.
Okay. Which, by the way, I just listened to a bunch of their records because I'm like, I want to see what, like, well, I just want to hear it all again.
Yeah.
Anyway. And so I just remember, like, listening, being in my room, shooting my Nerf hoop, and like getting like whatever I could use as a guitar to pretend like mm-hmm. I'm in this. I don't know why, but that music just connected with me. Mm-hmm. And when I was 14, I got my first guitar, freshman in high school. And I knew, like, I wanted to learn guitar. I wanted to learn how to play. But I don't know if some of you may have experienced this. You pick it up and you're like, these guys do awesome stuff with this thing. And you just couldn't figure it out.
Yeah. You didn't have YouTube.
There was no YouTube at the time. Yes. Yeah. Long time before YouTube. Yeah. But so my mom and dad got me this guitar for Christmas, my freshman year of high school, and then they got me guitar lessons. And so I started learning how to play. And I went about a year, and it was a little bit of a frustrating process, mm-hmm. but there was this moment where something kind of clicked. Part of that was learning that my guitar teacher was amazing. He was kind of a local Indianapolis area legend. Mm-hmm. But I realized, like, oh, I'm kind of just playing like him. Like, I'm learning how to play like Mike. His name is Mike Shepherd. I'm learning how to play like Mike. So I'm like, after about a year, I quit guitar lessons because I wanted to figure out, like, what is it that I want to create? What do I want
to
do? So
that's pretty cool at that young of an age to recognize that you want to find your own
voice,
so to speak.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I don't know that I would have known that at the mm-hmm. point. I just knew that, like, okay, I'm learning all these cover songs, but I'm real interested in, like, learning how to write. Like, writing was always a part mm-hmm. of what I was passionate about and have been, continue to be. But anyway, so I started playing. My youth pastor growing up, Angela, my wife, and I grew up together in the same youth group. And he knew, like, I was learning guitar, and he's like, I'd started this little, it's funny, it's this metal band.
That's amazing.
I mean, like, when I think about it, it's just like, oh my gosh. But everybody's got their story, right? Everybody's got their, like, this is my, this is the beginnings. But even though we were horrible, my youth pastor, his name is Jeff Kuhn, great, great man, still a great friend, invited us to, like, play for youth group one night. And I'm like, yes, let's do it. And so he really kind of gave me the opportunity to, mm-hmm. like, to learn how to, like, utilize this gift. And so, again, fast forward a couple years, I graduated high school. We continued to, you know, play in this little band. And I went to college. I went to a school called Kentucky Christian College. Mm-hmm. It's Kentucky Christian University now. I don't know that it matters. I think they just, I don't know. They got
stepped
a couple more programs or something. Yeah. Yeah. I don't know why. I don't know what makes a difference. But I met a couple of guys. The first year I was there, I met a guy named Matt Gingrich, who mm-hmm. actually was one of the founding members of Bleach with me. We just started, like, but we had this passion, and we just started pursuing, like, mm-hmm. like, let's just write songs. And, you know, mm-hmm. never, ever, ever. He's from Millersburg, Ohio. It's Amish country. Literally, his grandfather is full on, his dad left the Amish church. Mm-hmm. So he's the first generation out of Amish. So, like, all of these things are like, this does not make sense. We all come from these little tiny Indiana, Ohio kind of communities. So when I think about it, I'm like, Bleach is the band that never should have been, mm-hmm. right? Like, mm-hmm. so we're in college, and we start playing, and you know, we're just doing stuff for fun. But at KCC, you had to have a certain amount of service points to graduate. Mm-hmm. So serving was a big part of what it, you know, like if you also, you were, it was a double major. So you always had a Bible major and then whatever your other major was. Mm-hmm. And so there was that. And then you had to have X amount of service points to get your degree. And so about our sophomore year, we asked our, the president of the college, we're like, hey, Dr. Curran was his name. We're like, hey, Dr. K, like if, say, because all of our friends had youth ministries, like mm-hmm. weekend ministries, mm-hmm. and I actually did too. It was a big part of my kind of college years. But we're like, if we go play shows for our youth pastor's friend, like our youth pastor friends, like youth ministries, can we get service points for doing that? And so he, you know, they met as a board, and they're like, yeah, we'll let you do that.
That's cool.
So we're like, okay, cool. So because we were just trying to figure out Part of this was a big part of my college career was bass fishing and skateboarding. Those were two of my passions. And so I was also the president of student council, which is really funny because just to be real honest, like I was on academic probation about every other semester because, you know,
yeah.
like I loved my theology studies, but mm-hmm. all the other stuff like math and yeah. like, I'm like,
I got into college under academic probation.
Okay. So, you know, so that was yeah. my story. It was like, I would have to meet every other semester with the board and be like, okay, I promise I won't bass fish and skateboard as much this time. But for whatever, they always saw something bigger and beyond yeah. that, you know, yeah. and I'm grateful for that. Yes.
Shout out to Kentucky.
Yeah.
Christian.
KCC, man. So anyway, so we started playing all these shows mm-hmm. at our youth pastor buddies' youth ministries. And then there was another band that came from KCC called Audio Adrenaline,
oh.
which a lot of people know. They were a couple years ahead of us, and mm-hmm. they had already kind of started, you know, they had signed with Forefront Records, which was, funny enough, it was Eddie DeGarmo from DeGarmo and Key. Yeah. It was his record label. So I remember KCC does this thing called Summer in the Sun every year, which is like a camp. It's mm-hmm. like a summer camp thing. And they had invited us to kind of like play. So we play this thing. And for us at the time, it's like, we've reached it. Like, this yeah. is the pinnacle yeah. of like,
you've arrived.
We're done. Mm-hmm. Like, it was Wimbledon, you know?
Yeah.
So that Audio Adrenaline was playing that camp too. Mm-hmm. And so anyway, their guitar player, Barry Blair, had heard a demo that we had done mm-hmm. and was like, hey, he heard something. So he's like, hey, I'd love to come and produce a demo for you guys. Mm-hmm. Cause at that point we didn't know how to tune guitars. It was just horrible.
Wow.
So also the gift in this is that, okay, somehow God like allowed Barry to hear something that probably nobody else would.
Yeah. I love that you're like the working through all the imperfection. Like,
yeah.
you know.
Oh, we were totally, so mm-hmm. you know, it was we had no clue what we were doing. Yeah. We didn't have any, there was nothing that we knew about how to do this. Mm-hmm. So Barry came along. We did a 6 or 7 song demo with mm-hmm. him. And that was kind of, we thought, well, we've reached it. Mm-hmm. Like Barry Blair produced this thing. So now we're just going to dominate the college circuit, you mm-hmm. know, like 3 colleges that were in our
yeah.
brotherhood. And so anyway, we went home. That was probably in the fall.
Mm-hmm.
We hadn't heard anything for a while. And then Barry happened to be at a Christmas party for Forefront.
Mm-hmm.
And Eddie DeGarmo was like, hey, what have you been up to? Barry was like, hey, I've been producing this band from KCC, and Eddie was like, well, let me hear it. So Barry played him this demo, and Eddie he loved it. So Barry called us and is like, hey, Eddie really likes this. Like, he wants to talk to you guys. We're like, no way. Because for me,
yeah.
that was the first rock and
yeah.
roll. Eddie DeGarmo was the
yeah.
keyboard player and singer for the first rock and roll band that I ever really loved.
Mm-hmm.
So like, he was, you know, it yeah. was like, you know, I don't know, it was just unbelievable to me
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
being this little Indiana kid. So we, you know, I'm fast forwarding, but we, long story short, he ended up coming, seeing us. We played a few shows for him and he came too. And, we played at a church called Post Road Christian Church in Indianapolis, mm-hmm. and it was in 1995, and we knew Eddie was going to be there, and he asked us to invite our parents to come. Okay. So we play the show, and the first thing Eddie does when we get off the stage is just, I mean, rip us a new one.
Oh, wow.
About, like, you guys don't know how to tune your guitars. Davey, you're overweight. You can't, you're out of breath. You can't sing these songs without being.
Oh, my gosh.
Like, I mean, just ripped us apart. We're like,
yeah.
There goes our dream.
Yeah.
Everything we've dreamed of. And he said, I want to talk to your parents. This is right after the show. Because we're all, like, at the time, like, college kids, like, yeah. 18 years old. So, so he pulls them back to this other room, talks with them.
Without you? Or
without
with
us.
You?
Without okay. us. Mm-hmm. And then he comes out, and his whole point was he knew our moms and dads had invested a ton of money into our college careers. Mm-hmm. He wanted to offer us a record deal, but he would not sign us unless every parent said,
oh,
we're okay
awesome.
With you, with them. Because it was going to, you know, we had to,
you had to drop out of school.
Out of school, and I was in my senior year, wow. you know.
And were they all on board?
Every single parent.
Dang.
Said yes. And so Eddie walked out and he's like, all right, boys, I want to talk to you. And basically at that point offered us a record deal.
Yeah.
Which was kind of the beginning of the rest of the story mm-hmm. for us. And all I remember, they still give me a hard time about it today because I'm kind of like a puppy mm-hmm. When it comes to excitement. Mm-hmm. Like when I get excited, like mm-hmm. I pee everywhere or whatever, right? Like so... we can edit that part out, but I
don't think so.
Okay, leave it. So all I remember was Eddie was like, all right, guys, I've talked to your moms and dads, and here's what I want to offer you. And that's all I remember. And I could not control myself. Like, I was so excited. I just took off running. Like, I ran out the door, and I did a whole lap around this monster
gosh.
Parking lot before I could just have the calmness to come in and have the conversation.
That's amazing.
So I was so excited.
That's amazing.
And it wasn't just that, but it's also like, this is Eddie DeGarmo.
Yeah.
This is like my hero mm-hmm. who believes in my music and these yeah. things we're writing and saying and wants to give us something that at that point there was no YouTube. The internet didn't exist.
Right.
I mean, it existed, but it was in its very infancies. There was mm-hmm. no, and so the only way you could kind of have a career that was beyond local or regional was to have backing from yeah. a record label.
Yeah.
And so it was just like this dream come true. And so we ended up moving to Nashville in 1995. Mm-hmm. There was nothing past Cool Springs Galleria. Mm-hmm. It was all like fields and woods.
Yeah.
And and so we toured for about 10 years. We did about, our average is probably 200 shows a year, sometimes mm-hmm. up to 250.
Yeah.
And so, it was just nonstop.
You built quite a following. I mean, we have people that have reached out to us because they've heard that you guys are playing again yeah. on the 17th, and they're coming here from places to hear you guys. So after 10 years, what made you change direction?
You know, it's interesting. So two of the guys in our band, so there was a couple lineups mm-hmm. of Bleach. There was the original that we all met in college. Mm-hmm. And then a couple guys got married and didn't want to tour anymore. And there was definitely a season where Davey, there was a guy named Davey Basinger, Matt Gingrich, Todd Kirby, Brad Ford, and myself are the original guys that started it. Well, Brad got off the road, Matt got off the road, and Todd got off the road. So it was just me and Davey in about 2000. And we always said, after the first couple guys stopped touring, we always said, hey, if any more stop, let's hang it up. So when Matt quit, our drummer, Davey and I were like, well, this is it. We just need to kind of hang it up.
Yeah.
Right? That would have been about 4 or 5 years in. And but Matt and all the other guys were like, Davey, Sam, like, this is your guys' path. Like, keep doing this. Don't quit just because, you know, we made this agreement, but we want you guys to keep going. Mm-hmm. So we ended up bringing three other guys into the band. And two of the guys, Milam and Jared Byers, were just guys that we had met on the road over mm-hmm. the years. Well, their brother, his name is Josh Byers, was a captain in the Army. Mm-hmm. And in 2003 was killed by an IED.
Oh, wow.
And
What's an IED? I don't know what that is.
It's a roadside bomb.
Okay.
In Iraq. Mm-hmm. And I think it was Fallujah is the area that he was killed in. So he was the, like a West Point grad, like he was a guy who was kind of writing the strategy for how do we deal with this conflict? So basically he was assassinated. And that was really, really hard. Mm-hmm. The last thing Josh said to me before he went over there is, promise me you'll take care of my brothers. And so
that's heavy. Sam.
It's real heavy. We were the same age. So he was 29 when he was killed. And he and I were great friends and had connected on whole, like just a heart, deep heart level. And so there was that.
Mm-hmm.
There's also, I had my oldest son, Journey, had just been, he was about a year old, and we were pregnant with our daughter.
Mm-hmm.
So there were just a lot of kind of life circumstances that were, we just felt like we just need to be home. And for me, I felt like it's real hard for me to be a good daddy and husband being gone 250 days a year.
Yeah.
And I'd watched so many of my friends walk through challenges in their marriage, challenges in their parenting, that some were just like, I don't care. This is my passion. I'm going to keep doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, I'm not willing to I'm not willing to do that. Like,
so you come off the road.
Yep.
And then what did you do?
So when I came off the road, I'm grateful. We had a guy named Keith Shackelford, who was our manager, and he had really helped us prepare to come off the road. So we had about a year where we weren't in any debt, which is rare for a band.
Yeah.
And actually had a pretty great, about it, where each of us could take about a year to kind of figure out what was next.
Mm-hmm.
So I took about 6 months, and then I was in a wedding with a guy named Ethan Luck, who he's a local artist. Everybody knows, he was in Supertones and Reliant K, and a lot of people know Ethan. But I was one of his groomsmen in his wedding, and when we were there, a couple of my other buddies who ran this venue called Rocket Town, were like, "Hey, we're looking for an entertainment manager, basically a promoter for Rocket Town.
Well,
you want to apply?" I'm like, "Yeah." So I came home from the wedding and I applied and sent him my resume and kind of, long story short, I ended up kind of promoting. I was the promoter at Rocket Town for about 4 years.
Wow, that's cool.
Yeah, yeah. So the beauty was, it was kind of, for me, it was a nice step of moving from like the touring world to like, I'm still involved in music and bands and artists. It was a little different way of doing it, but it was kind of, it just kind of eased.
Yeah.
For me, it was easing out of the challenge with Rocket Town was, it was kind of a 3-person job, you know, at that point. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'd go in the morning at 10 a.m. and come home at 3 a.m.
Yeah.
And so it was almost like, well, I wasn't much different than being on the road. And so I decided to kind of move out of that. At the same time, I was doing the youth ministry at Journey. So Journey
just as a volunteer.
As a volunteer.
Okay.
And then it became part time. So I volunteered. Basically, when we came to Journey, it was called Crossroads. Okay. Then it became Ecclesia. And then Journey and Ecclesia merged together, right? So there's a few different phases of it. But when we were at Crossroads, there was no youth ministry. It was, we were in the factory. It was just, you know, there's a couple hundred people. And and I'm like, man, there's quite a few teenagers here that let's just connect, you know?
Yeah.
So I asked if I could do something on Sundays. And the pastor, Tim Bassanio, at the time was like, yeah, dude, do it. And so we just kind of started it from there. And then I ended up, about 2007, moving to Seattle to work as the creative arts pastor at a church in Seattle. I was there for about 4 years, and then I planted a church in Chicago called The Anchor in 2010.
So you did The Anchor from Seattle?
Yes.
So you went,
so I went from
Nashville,
went from
Seattle.
I went from, yeah, so it was Journey at the time. It was just the beginnings of Journey. I moved to, actually, Jamie, who was our former pastor, and some of the elders ordained me and sent me to Seattle to work at the church there. And then from there, I moved to Chicago to plant a church. And was there for about 5 years.
Wow.
Yeah. And then came back to Journey. You can't keep me away from this place.
So then when you came back to Journey, did you come back to work at Journey, or did you come back and then?
Yeah. So I had, what I learned through church planning was, I'd say the biggest takeaway for me was being in the right lane is real important.
Yeah.
right?
Especially in ministry.
In ministry, yes. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Well, anywhere, but yeah.
Yes. So about 3 years, it was great. Like I loved what I was doing. Mm-hmm. And then about the church had grown and had become self-sustaining. Like it was this amazing community and I loved what I was doing. But I was about three years in, I realized I'm in the wrong lane. My role had shifted from people, kind of like just in it with people to like kind of overseeing the whole of the ministry, and it was more of administrative, and anyone who knows me knows that is not my gift. Administration is probably the least of my gifts. And so I got burned out.
Yeah.
Is what happened. So the church was awesome and doing well, but I was shriveling in the midst of that. And so after about 2 years and feeling like, man, I'm just a crappy dad and husband and I'm not leading well. Like I just was like, I need to make a shift. And so I came down to meet with Jamie and Gary and Aaron, some of the guys that were, you know, pastors here at the time to just let them know like, all right, guys, I'm burned out. I'm done. I don't know what I'm going to do next, but I feel like I'm in order to be healthy at all moving forward, I gotta step away from this. And all of them, like I basically vomited on them for about 2 hours. And the end of the conversation, towards the end, they just started kind of giggling. And I'm like, what are you guys giggling about? Like I could not grab it because I'm like, I'm literally just like, I'm pouring my heart out and you guys think it's funny. Well, the beauty in that was that kind of at different times, each of them had felt like God was speaking to them about inviting me to come back to Journey to work. And so they invited me back and I was like, nope, I do not want to have anything to do right now with church and ministry. And I'm just burned out. I'm done. And so Gary Carter, man, that dude just kept pursuing and just kept reaching out and just kept, man, are you sure? Like, and so after about three months or so of that, in the midst of all that, my heart was shifting and I was starting to see things a little more clearly.
Yeah.
Some of it was just burned out and irritated and just like, I don't, I was like, I just felt like the release.
And you were given permission to heal while you served.
That's the beauty of this place to me is the first year, maybe even more, maybe for, I'll even say 2 years. I've been back 6 years now. The first, at least year, I felt still kind of like, I don't have anything to offer. Like they're providing for me and my family. And I didn't feel like I had a lot to give, but they just encouraged me and allowed me to heal through that process. And then there was this moment of, cause I came back as our serve pastor, right? And, you know, like, and anybody from a journey, you know, our roles have shifted a couple times over the years, right?
A few, yeah. Right?
And so, I just, what I felt like what I was burned out on was just, and as horrible as it sounds, I'm just being honest. Like I felt like it was people that were burning me out. Like, okay, like, and what I realized is no. It was actually the opposite of that. People were what were giving me life and not being able to kind of engage with people in the same way that I did when we started the church was what was burning me out. And so after about a year, I kind of recognized that here. And Jamie just called me in the office. He said, hey, man, because part of it was people were just, for whatever reason, I don't, and I just kind of, I just go, okay, this is a God thing. I don't try and figure it out or explain it. But ever since I was a kid, like people will kind of always come to me when it comes to to their troubles or they want to they want to sit and talk. And so
you're a very safe person.
I hope so.
Well, we were laughing a few moments ago about what's not your gift, right? Administration, organization, and that type of thing. But what is your gift is people and caring for people and walking alongside people for sure.
Yeah.
So, what is it about your job currently that you love? Like, what are you loving right now?
Well, I mean, I love being able to. And I've described my job oftentimes as like kind of like triage at the hospital.
Yeah. And it's weird to actually, like, I have a little hesitation in even calling it a job because it is. I mean, you have a position here, a role, and you're paid for it. But it really is who you are.
I'm going to do that regardless. Yeah.
You really are. You really are. So tell us what it is that you do love that's life-giving.
Well, I think it's for me the thing that's most life-giving with my job is kind of the aha. Mm-hmm. Whether people they've been on a like kind of heading the direction, they're like, wait a minute, there's something different. There's something better. Like, because I realize that most of the time people know the answer.
Yeah.
Sometimes they just need somebody to walk beside them and help kind of gently guide them to seeing that in mm-hmm. themselves. And I love when people mm-hmm. recognize that, wait a minute, it's been here all along.
Yeah.
It's just the being with people that I mm-hmm. that I love and being able to encourage or help or the one of the things that I really enjoy is I've always kind of approached it with looking for like what are the connection points between mm-hmm. me and this person mm-hmm. whether it's something in our story or something in common and mm-hmm. so I tend to gravitate towards what those things are because mm-hmm. that creates a trust and
yeah.
it creates a mm-hmm. like a foundation that then we can kind of move forward. Mm-hmm. And so there's something to I guess it's the beauty of just the way we're all created is that some of us mm-hmm. are gifted in that, some of us aren't. And so I've finally become okay with, you know, I think that's what I've kind of been created for.
Do you miss being on the road? Do you miss music?
Well, there's things about it I miss.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I think it's funny because what I've realized over the last, I mean, we stopped touring in 2004. So mm-hmm. we're like, what, 17 years? I mean, mm-hmm. I've been off the road twice as long as I was on the road almost yeah. now, you know? And people ask this question oftentimes. And I do. There's things that I miss. But the thing that I realized, like the studio, I love doing the studio. I love being mm-hmm. in the studio and creating and writing mm-hmm. music. But what always like drove me was that connection you would have with somebody from the stage. Like, okay, I wrote this song or we wrote this song from something that was, you know, intimate or true to us. And I see 1,000 kids singing every word to this. And mm-hmm. so it's true to them too.
That's awesome.
And so what I've realized is the things that I've experienced as a little Hoosier mm-hmm. from 1500 farm, you know, town of 1500 people in farm town, Indiana is that, man, we just all share a lot of the
yeah.
similar experiences.
It's those connection points. Again.
It is. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And so I always loved, whether it was the stories that I would hear from like, you know, this song, like, I was struggling and the words to this song or whatever, it just kind of helped me through this or mm-hmm. it was those moments of connection with people's hearts that were mm-hmm. always the thing that so I miss having that but I still have that
yeah.
that's the thing so
just in that way
yeah
that was the
yeah.
part
and yeah. it was pretty awesome to get paid to go see all the world
yeah
right
that's
like I mean
gig.
You can't you can't complain about that like now you know now I'm like
well you did go to Brazil with me
that's true
and you went to Israel
I still get to do it I'm so in Honduras
awesome.
With Ty and,
yeah
yeah I think yeah, there's just something about, I mean, I get irritated every time we go to like an amusement park now. I'm like, I got to pay to come to this place.
Yeah.
Like they used to pay me a lot of money to come. And then I get, you know, we get to ride all these rides for free, you know. But, you know, so those kind
yeah.
of stuff like that, it was fun, you know, I miss. And just, I do miss there was a unique kind of community that's developed when mm-hmm. you're with, you know, we'd usually have 10 or 12 people out with us mm-hmm. all the time, you know, five of us and then our crew. There's a brotherhood.
Yeah, you're living together.
You're in the
yeah.
trenches together.
Yeah.
And so, but it's also what I appreciate about our community here and mm-hmm. and our staff here at Journey. And mm-hmm. like we get to experience that. It's different, but it's the same kind of connection,
yeah.
you know?
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Well, people can come and see you and hear you and experience the glory of Bleach on
yep.
July 17th.
Yeah.
And
come on.
People can come and hear you teach on Sunday,
July 4th.
It's
been a while. Since I've done that. So.
Well, that's good. I'm excited to learn
it'll
from
be
you
fun.
That day.
It'll be fun.
Thank you, Sam.
Yeah. Absolutely. Thanks, Cece.
everyone, if you want to buy tickets to Journey Fest, you actually don't have to buy them because they're free. You can go to our website, journeytn.com, and you'll find the information there and come and join us, be with us, celebrate being together, and enjoy some good music, food trucks.
journeytn.com/events.
journeytn.com/events.
Forward slash.
Bye, everyone.
See ya.
If you enjoyed today's episode, we would love it if you would share a screenshot of this episode to your Instagram story and tag us at journey_TN. And don't forget to subscribe and leave us a review on your favorite podcasting app.